to lecture number 10 in our series on the foundations of Western civilization. In the last couple of lectures, we talked about Sparta, then about Athens, two of the most famous and most important of the Greek poleis, the Greek city-states. We talked about them as social and political institutions. What I want to turn to now, in a series of several lectures, actually, is the culture of the polis. What kind of culture did these cities make? Now, if we think about it for just a moment, there are certain common features to the culture of cities, and then every city has distinctive features all its own. Boston is not quite like New York. New York is not like Los Angeles. Los Angeles is different from Chicago. Perfectly natural. And yet they do have some things in common. Most of what we know about the culture of the Athenian, of the Greek polis, we know about the Athenian polis. So in certain respects, we can't really generalize to the culture of the polis overall. What we know is really about Athens. And so, let us visit that great city. Let's take several vantage points on its finest period, the Golden Age, the 5th century BC, the classical period. Let's begin with the most public of cultural manifestations, the most public of art forms. In Athens, this means architecture and drama. Now, no cultural form is more public or communal than architecture. Great civic buildings are just there. We see them every day. We like them or we don't like them. We argue about them. We praise them, we criticize them, but there they are. And so buildings can tell us some interesting and important things about the places where they are and the people who built them. Now in Athens, drama is very important too, and we'll turn to that in a few minutes. Homer mentions temples. As we saw in an earlier lecture, the Homeric poems probably took something like their contemporary shape in about 725 BC, plus or minus a bit. So can't necessarily argue from Homer, again we talked about this, as proving that there were temples in the Mycenaean world, but certainly the fact that Homer mentions temples means they existed in his time. In the Dark Ages, and in the Archaic period in Greece, as near as we can tell from the surviving archaeological record, people no longer built palaces and no longer built urban fortifications on the scale of the Mycenaean period. Architecture was perhaps, we might say, increasingly civic, but it served the civic purposes of these emerging poleis. Public buildings where, for example, legislative deliberations could take place, temples, for example, where the people of the city might worship their gods. Greek colonies. We've talked about the Greek colonies around the Mediterranean world and how important that was. The Greek colonies tended to build architecture that mirrored the architecture of the metropolis that had sent them out in the first place. So, not surprisingly, we find not great palace complexes in Mycenaean fashion, but rather temples and public buildings in the fashion of the dawning polis. Pisistratus, as we saw, built a considerable number of buildings in Athens, or was responsible for having them built, and partly this was to generate pride, to sustain pride in the city of Athens. Partly was to put large numbers of people to work, but it does point to this civic context for architecture and building buildings in a city that were going to enter into some kind of a dialogue with the people who lived in that city. Now, during the Persian Wars, I keep referring to the Persian Wars and keep promising that eventually we'll talk about them, but once more we're going to pass right by, except to say that during the Persian Wars, the Persian army entered, sacked, and burned much of Athens. So much of the great civic structure, the great civic fabric that Pisistratus had created, was gone. This, of course, then left a remarkable opportunity for people of the generation of Pericles. The restoration of peace, then, and the revenues that flowed into Athens from the Athenian Empire provided the wherewithal to build these buildings. So there was will, there was opportunity, and there were material resources. Well, there were a large number of buildings built between the 450s and about 420 BC in Athens, a number of very beautiful ones. But the greatest, the most important, I think in many ways the most interesting of these is the Parthenon. So let's talk about the Parthenon a little bit as a way of talking about a Greek temple and a Greek building, and we can learn a little something about the form by discussing the Parthenon, and then move along a little bit to ask ourselves, what does the Parthenon tell us about Athens and about the Athenians? How can we read this building as a contemporary document? Well, the Parthenon is the temple to Athena Parthenos, Athena the maiden, Athena, not surprisingly, the patron deity of Athens. The building is built between about 447 or 446 BC and about 438. So the basic temple itself is built over a period of about 8 or 9 years. Its sculptural programs, more about them in just a couple of minutes, its sculptural programs were completed by about 432. So this great building is put up in less than 2 decades. Now, in case you're interested, we do actually know the names of the architects who were most responsible for designing the building were Ictinus and Callicrates. Now, it's a bit puzzling here because we can't confidently identify other buildings that they built, and yet they were so good, they must have done other work. Their signature must be someplace else. The principal sculptor was Phidias. It was he who did the great golden statue of Athena that was inside the temple itself. That statue disappeared already in antiquity. We have no idea what became of it. But Phidias, the greatest of the sculptors in Athens at that time, was commissioned to make the great sculpture of Athena. Now, in order to understand the Parthenon in particular, let us, in general, talk about the elements of a Greek building. Let's talk about the elements of a temple, the temple structure. Though the temple structure was a form of building that could actually be adapted to a large number of other uses. We're going to see this later when we talk about Romans. The basilica is basically a large rectangular hall, which can be adapted to lots of purposes. So I'm going to be talking about a temple form here, but that doesn't mean that every building like this is and only is a temple. All right. The key elements of a floor plan, let us imagine a Greek temple's floor plan from two points of view. Imagine that you are standing on the ground, even with the temple, and looking straight at it, but like Superman, you have X-ray vision, so you can look right through it. You can kind of see how all the elements work. Now, let's hoist you up in the air in a helicopter above it, and you look straight down at it. All right. So what I want you to do is imagine those two views, so that in a certain sense what we have are horizontal and vertical dimensions. And we're going to try to understand how these horizontal and vertical dimensions operate in tandem with one another. Now, we can refer to the main horizontal dimension as the stereobate, and we can refer to the main vertical dimension as the stilobate. Those are terms that may or may not be helpful as we go along. Let's put it this way, a bit more simply. You build a floor. Now, the floor may be built up several steps and several levels, and then you build a structure on that floor. The structure will generally consist then of this base of this floor, possibly with steps leading up to it. There will then be a colonnade. We can call that a peristyle. We have a colonnade that runs around the building, usually on 4 sides, not absolutely always on 4 sides, but usually it goes around on 4 sides. Inside that colonnade is one or more chambers. We call this the cella, the cell, the room on the inside of a temple. Okay? So that's the very basic structure. There will ordinarily be passageways around the inside of the colonnade, for example, and then perhaps inside the temple itself. Now, if we start to think about the vertical dimensions of such a building, the key vertical element, the thing we see most obviously, are the columns. Are the columns, right? A column consists always of 2 and sometimes of 3 parts. A column has a shaft. The shafts may be smooth on the outside, or they may be fluted, as we say. Fluted means grooved, right? The column may have a capital. Excuse me. The column will always have a capital. This is a more or less elaborate design on the top of the column. The column may have a base, a pedestal. This we do not always see. So you've always got a shaft, and you've always got a capital, and you sometimes have a base or a pedestal at the foot of the column. Now, The Greeks elaborated three basic ways of designing and thinking about their columns. In the classical period, the period that concerns us, the Doric and the Ionic orders were the commonest. Now, it will occur to you to ask, does that mean the Doric came from Sparta and the Ionic from Asia Minor? The answer to that question is a resounding maybe. They are named Doric and Ionic, and the Greeks certainly had a sense that this is where they came from. It is not crystal clear that, for example, the Doric is born in Sparta. You see? All right. A Doric column is a column that is very slightly fatter in the middle than at the top or at the bottom. It usually does not have a pedestal. It usually has a very flat, very simple, very unadorned capital. It is sturdy. It is vigorous. It is powerful. It conveys a sense of durability, of strength. The Ionic order is rather different. Tall, graceful, slender, elegant columns. Always fluted. Fluted very deeply with relatively narrow flutes. It always rests on a pedestal, more or less complex from one place to another, and it usually has a scrolled capital. It looks like a great book scroll. Perhaps you've seen pictures of a scroll, you see? So you imagine laying a scroll over the top of the column. And that's what the capital of an Ionic column looks like. Now, a Corinthian column, more or less in many respects, kind of splits the difference in terms of size, shape, and look of a Doric and Ionic. It's not quite as heavy and massive as the Doric. It's not quite as slender and graceful as the Ionic. Its distinctive feature is an acanthus leaf capital. This became popular later in the Greek world, really after the classical period, and it was particularly favored by the Romans. The Romans built in Corinthian again and again and again and again. But we can say that the Corinthian was somewhat less in evidence in classical Athens. Now, at the very top of these columns, at the very top of these columns, we have a system called the entablature. The entablature is basically the horizontal dimension that sits on top of the vertical columns. Now, imagine this. The Greeks build in what we call post and lintel architecture. If you could hold your thumbs up about 6 inches apart and balance a pencil across them, you have two posts and a lintel. The pencil is the lintel. Lintels can, of course, run from column to column to column to column along the exterior, along the colonnade, or they can extend from column tops back to the walls, the interior walls of the cella. And in most temples, they did both things. On the top of those lintels springs the roof, framed in, sometimes in wood, sometimes in stone, often a combination of the two, framed on top of the horizontal elements that sit on top of the columns. Those entablatures, as we call this horizontal business that sits on top of the vertical columns, the entablatures are important to us for a couple of reasons. They were very beautiful, they could be very intricate, they could be very complex, but they very often have flat, rectangular, sometimes square, but usually rectangular patterns, plaques, called metopes. And here, sculpture was put. Here, sculptures were put. Flat, frieze sculptures were placed in these metopes. So, the buildings have architectural dimensions, and the decorative dimensions of the buildings also give us certain artistic opportunities. The Parthenon itself was in almost perfect condition in Athens, until it was hit by a stray shell in 1687. The Turks controlled Athens at that time, and they were actually using the Parthenon as a powder magazine. And a stray shell from a Venetian ship struck the Parthenon, blew the roof off, and blew off a considerable part of the colonnade on one side, and left it in the ruined state in which we find it today. Fortunately, there were drawings made in 1674 of the building as a whole, though we had other reason to know what the building as a whole would have looked like. These drawings are crucial to us because they show us all of the sculpture in situ. Now, of course, that sculpture is scattered all over the place, and much of the finest of it, the so-called Elgin marbles, are in the British Museum in London. This has been a considerable bone of contention between the Greek and British governments for a very long time. So if you really want to see the Parthenon sculpture, you don't go to Athens, you go to London. The Parthenon is more than 100 feet long on its two lateral sides. It's a very big building. It has 8 columns across the front instead of the usual 6. It has 17 down each side instead of the usual 12 or 15. It is a very big building. It's meant to be big and impressive. The floors all curve slightly outward from a point in the very center of the floor. They bow slightly out towards the corners as a means of trying to defeat the ordinary foreshortening that we have when we look at a building. In other words, the builders of the Parthenon tried very hard to play an optical illusion on an optical illusion. The point of foreshortening, of course, is if you stand, say, between two railroad tracks and look down the track. It looks as if at a point in the distance the two tracks come together and converge. We know perfectly well that they don't. Normally, if you look at a temple, it looks as you're looking down the colonnade as if the columns at the back are shorter than the ones at the front. By building the Parthenon with curving surfaces, an attempt was made to limit somewhat that sense of foreshortening. It's also true, for example, that the columns of the Parthenon at a point about a mile and a quarter above the building would touch one another exactly over the center of the floor. This is a remarkable building, and none of that was designed in by accident. It's large, but it is also graceful. It is elegant. It is beautiful. Now, curiously enough, as you may know, if you wish to see what the Parthenon actually looked like, don't go to Athens, you go to Nashville, Tennessee, where there is a scale model of it, built in stone, and one can see it. Actually, it's built in concrete, but one can see it to this day looking rather like it looked in antiquity. The Parthenon has three great sculptural programs. These programs are meant to depict important things from the history of Athens. The pediments, the triangular ends of the building, depict, on the one hand, the birth of Athena, and on the other end, the battle between Athena and Poseidon for control of Athens. Two great mythical historical events in the history of the city. The metopes, these panels going around the entablature, have a whole series of historical stories. Greeks and the Trojans, the mythical battle of the Lapiths and the Centaurs, for example. Battles between the Greeks and the Amazons, for example. Now, this was not uncommon in temple architecture, to have mythical scenes from the past. In Athens, not surprisingly, Athenian contributions are featured. And Athens has given a very long, a very glorious history. Around the cella, however, there was a continuous frieze, which is a little bit new. This was probably, there's some controversy among art historians about exactly what was depicted there. But I think the prevailing view is that it is a depiction of the great Panathenaic festival. In other words, here, the Athenians are shown themselves now, not their glorious past. That's something interesting and important to think about with respect to the Athenians. The building was meant to talk to the Athenians. It was meant to make points to them. It was meant to make points about them. Its immense size was meant to be impressive. The cost of the building was to make Athenians proud, to make them accept the empire, to make them accept the price of all the sacrifices which they had paid. The historical, including the mythical sculptures, put Athens' long and proud history on public display for all to see, for anyone who was a citizen of Athens, for anyone who visited the city. The unusual secular scene of the Panathenaea held up a mirror to the Athenians in which they could see themselves reflected. So this was a building whose technical proficiency we must admire, but which also was a building engaged in a constant and continuing conversation with the people who built it. That's one public element of the culture of a polis. Another is drama. In many respects, the great public art at Athens was drama. It was performed in impressive open-air theaters. From the time of Ephialtes and Pericles, citizens at Athens got free tickets. Those are the things the empire paid for. Drama, of course, are running. Tragedy, the great dramatic form. What is tragedy? Well, the word means goat song. That's not very helpful. It suggests that the remote origins of tragedy go back to rather wild celebrations in honor of Dionysus, called by the Romans Bacchus. So if we were to think of a bacchanal, what kind of a party would a bacchanal be? One you hope your teenage kids don't have, that's what it is. So there was some kind of a primitive and rather wild, and perhaps rather woolly, celebration. By the 6th century BC, this began to be tamed a little bit. Tradition has it that a dramatist and actor named Thespis, now, actors are still thespians, performed the first dramatic tragedy in Athens around 530 BC. So the classical dramatic form began to lose whatever its origins were in the goat song and become tragedy, drama, as we would more familiarly recognize it. The oldest surviving play dates from about 470 BC. Here is a tragedy about tragedy. We know the names of more than 100 plays. Fewer than two dozen survive intact. We know the names of dozens of dramatists. We have plays by three. Aeschylus, who lives from 525 to 456 BC. Sophocles, who lives from 496 to 406 BC. And Euripides, from 485 to 406 BC. Our losses are enormous. Now for Aristotle, whose book The Poetics is the world's first work of literary criticism, tragedy was a kind of poetry. It was a kind of poetry that was serious, that was written in beautiful language, beautiful, moving, elegant language. And it aroused fear and pity. It aroused fear and pity in a way that was to purify the emotions of the audience. This was the great catharsis, the purification. Tragedy is fundamentally an elegant story of an admirable person struggling nobly against insuperable odds. It is not the ordinary and the accidental. It is not when someone, a great promise, dies in an automobile accident today. Aristotle would say, that's not tragic, it's not even interesting. Everybody's going to die anyway. It is the struggle that ennobles tragedy. That's the key point. Aeschylus, the first of the great dramatists whose works survive for us, wrote in trilogies, as we think other early dramatists did as well. Only one of his trilogies survives. Indeed, only one trilogy survives at all. And this is the Oresteia. Now, the Oresteia, the plays about Orestes, Orestes is a son of Agamemnon. While Agamemnon was off fighting the Trojan War, his wife Clytemnestra took up with another man, partly because her husband, she felt, had abandoned her, partly because her husband had sacrificed their daughter Iphigenia to get favorable winds in order for the Greek fleet to sail to Troy. Well, when Agamemnon came back from the Trojan Wars, Clytemnestra and her paramour killed him. Orestes was now faced with the task of avenging his father's death. So the three plays become a long meditation on the nature of justice, the nature of divine justice, the nature of human justice. Now, it is cast way in the past, and yet, this play is performed in Athens in 458, 4 years before the Areopagus was stripped of its last powers in Athens. Orestes is finally tried in the third play, before the Athenian Areopagus, except there, it's a court made up of the gods, you see. But the play is speaking profoundly to contemporary issues, to hot issues. And this is one important reason why this is a public art. It's not only public because it happens in public. It's public because it engages the great issues of the day. He also wrote, Aeschylus did, quite distinctive in this, a play called The Persians, the only play on a contemporary theme. He wrote a play about the Persians. The Persians had just attacked the Greeks, had burned Athens to the ground, and Aeschylus writes a play to show that the Persians are people too, that they have the same hopes and dreams and fears and aspirations as everyone else. The second of the great tragedians, Sophocles, abandoned the trilogy. His plays explored justice. They explored principle. They explored the consequences of right action. For Sophocles, there is always a profound tension between what I ought to do and what I want to do. Let's just think of two examples. One of his most famous plays is Antigone. Now, two men, Antigone's brothers, Polynices and Eteocles, have fought in single combat before the walls of Thebes. They've both died. Eteocles had actually been defending Thebes, Polynices attacking. So the king of Thebes at that time, a man named Creon, swore that Polynices' body was to be left there on the field to rot, was not to be buried. Now, this violated Greek taboos of all kinds. But Polynices' sister Antigone said, "The gods command that I bury my brother." She goes to the king and pleads to be permitted to bury her brother. The king says, no, I made a rule. You do not bury Polynices. Well, she goes out and buries him anyway. The king is then outraged, puts spies to find out who did this. They track Antigone down. He sentences her to death. She is to die by being walled up in a cave. What's going on in the play? What Sophocles is showing us is that Antigone is answering to a higher law than the law of men. Creon is a mere man. He makes rules, they come, they go. She is obeying the gods. She answers to a higher calling. Now, part of what is tragic about the play is Creon's son Hymen is Antigone's paramour, and they are to be married, and she kills herself, he kills himself, and Creon is disgraced, and the play goes on. The more familiar play is Oedipus Rex. The story of Oedipus the king, this wonderful man, this good, kind, just man, who through terrible quirks of fate has killed his own father and married his own mother. And the blind seer Tiresias again and again says, don't push it, don't ask questions, don't try to find out, there's more going on here than you know. Now this play is beautiful and brilliant for a lot of reasons. When you read it, one of the things to notice is all of the rope tying, bonding imagery in the play. These people are tied. Sight. Again and again there is discussion of sight. It is only blind Tiresias who at the beginning of the play can see. And at the end of the play it is only Oedipus when he's plucked out his own eyes and who becomes blind who then can see. We're all blind as we operate. But the point is that Sophocles shows us this man and says he has committed great offenses and for these he must be punished. Now we would probably say there's not a jury in the world that would convict Oedipus. Sophocles convicted. And that is the power of that play. And he's entering, as we'll see in a later lecture, into some of the great philosophical debates of his day. Euripides was unconventional in all kinds of ways. He gets rid of the chorus. He doesn't write trilogies. He adapted dramatic forms. He adds more actors. He's very inventive. He also is responding to the great philosophical issues of the day. His plays show emotion, revenge, jealousy, envy. For example, his play Electra. Electra is Orestes' sister. She also is outraged at the death of her father. But whereas for Aeschylus, the Oresteia is a great play about justice, for Euripides, the play Electra is about the sheer blind fury of Electra at the death of her beloved father. She reacts like an ordinary human being. No march of divine principle here, the rage of an individual person. So Athenian tragedy, one of the great public arts of Athens. There was another, comedy. Not all drama was tragic. Comedies tended to be stories set in the present, not in the remote past. Not among mythical characters, but among people who live now. Pointing again, as tragedy could do, pointing into contemporary issues, satirizing them, ridiculing them, holding prominent citizens up to spectacular abuse. Now, the greatest of the comedic writers was Aristophanes. His plays could be vulgar, but also beautiful and elegant and written in extraordinary verse. Aristophanes lived from 455 to 385 BC. He lives through, really, the Golden Age of Periclean Athens. If most people are familiar with one of his plays, I suspect it's the play Lysistrata, which is the play where Lysistrata, a woman of Athens, in order to stop the Peloponnesian War, the war between the Spartans and the Athenians, persuades the women of Athens to go on a sex strike. Well, the whole scene is absurd, but perhaps in the end you see the play is not meant to be absurd. Aristophanes is telling us something about a society at war. Contemporary themes run through the play. Another of his plays, The Clouds, pokes fun at contemporary philosophers, and actually, and quite unfairly, scoops up Socrates into the criticism and ridicules Socrates. So these comic arts and these tragic arts tell us a few very basic things about this Athenian polis. This is a very open society. This is a society where you can debate and say and argue about almost anything. This is a society of spectacular technical precision. When we think of the Parthenon as a building, When we think of the poetic arts of the Greek plays, we see an interest in craftsmanship almost unrivaled. But there is also a sense of fun, and there is a sense of seriousness. Now, another of the arts, and we've hinted at this many times, so now it's time to confront it straight on, that was very public in Athens, was the art of history. And to that we'll turn in our next lecture. Hello again, and welcome to the 11th of our lectures